Stanley Fall, Reel 5.
At that time, when I came to, he told me that what I've got to do is rest and eat and keep warm. Well, in order to eat, one had to work. And in order to keep warm, one had to have enough clothing because it was very severe. So it was how I survived this time, I don't know, because it must have been, again, somebody looking over me from above. Because all the circumstances were such, the weather was so foul, and unless you went to a working, joined a working party, you had no food, because there were no facilities for food. And how I survived it, I only believe that my reserves from Skalczyska Kamienne kept me going, because I was sort of on the starvation level for at least 4 weeks. But once I survived that, and the will to survive was there, I then started joining working parties and were taken to Weimar, which is the nearest town, and that was being bombed on a nightly basis, and by the mornings we were taken there in order to clear the roads, in order to let the traffic and the pedestrian walk past, because the buildings either side of Weimar were either burning or destroyed by the Allied bombers. And of course this was a wonderful thing for us prisoners to see that somebody is doing something and the war is going to finish. And we realized then that we've got to survive from day to day because it is coming to a close. And of course, at that time, the difference between Buchenwald and the Majdanek Oskarżyski was entirely different. That was a German concentration camp built for German criminals, political, like trade unionists who were political prisoners, communists who were political prisoners, and some of them were high-ranking Germans being political prisoners running the camps, and they were there put in by the Nazis as a... So I remember that they were... The treatment there was entirely different to the other two camps. There were no... there were German personnel guarding us instead of being the White Russians or the Bielorussians. And it was run on a much more civilized basis. But of course, at that time, it was tremendous turmoil because the Germans were getting worried because the Russians were coming. And from day to day, we didn't know if we were the next sort of portion of bread comes from, because even the Germans were short of bread. And I don't know if I mentioned the good part, which one working party, when a German asked for four of us to come in and to come out from the working party and join the minister's home. And he was a retired general from the First World War. And he asked one of the German guards that he wanted to be pointed to me and to three other young men. And the German guard said, no, if you want to invite, take somebody else, take the German, the German political prisoners in the same group. And he said, no, you picked out four Jewish prisoners with the Star of David. And the guard said, no, you've got to go to the superior officer. So he did go, and the superior officer came down, and he said, I don't remembered the story, but he asked him about in an argument, and he showed him what the rank he was, and he permitted us to go into their home. I remember this clearly. Of course, it was a freezing cold day, probably it was February 1945, and his wife, to me, I mean, he must have been a man of about 55, he looked an old man, and his wife was probably only about 50, 55, and she was crying, and they took us to a beautiful, very old-fashioned house, and on the very large mantelpiece, there were three photographs of three Air Force, or the Luftwaffe men, which were three of their sons, with black ribbons across. And she explained to us in German, which we understood, that the three of them were lost on the Russian front. And the three single boys, they were never married, they were all young boys, they were about 18, 19, 20. And she wanted to do something, she had very little to give us, and what she wanted to do was that she had some potatoes and she roasted the potatoes on the fireplace and sat down with a cup of ersatz coffee, because coffee was something unattainable, and that's all she had, she wanted to, which was very touching. And what I'm saying is there were some very good, decent Germans, and they were the minority of the Nazis. So you're dealing with a good, but the bad overtook the good, as it were. That was my experience.
I expect that was very important, wasn't it, to have a bit of kindness?
Well, to see, not only the kindness, but to see that the Germans themselves suffered. It's the first opportunity I had to see that the war wasn't just one-sided against us, or against the Poles, or against the Russians, or against the... But the Germans themselves, no fault of their own, suffered and lost their own families for a futile war.
Yes, it's interesting you now saying, Stanley, that you're in Germany, and the difference in the treatment in the camp and the organisation. But I suppose when you were doing your clearing job, civilians were passing you, is that right? You saw quite a lot of civilian life, apart from this general and his wife.
Well, the only civilians we have seen were either in uniform on leave, or in uniform without a leg or an arm, which meant that they were on a permanent leave, or elderly people who are either retired or very, very young. The general population in Weimar at the time, when we went out from our camp in order to clear away, were shabbily dressed, badly underfed, the people I have seen were as badly off as we were, because they had nothing. There was the destruction at that time was electricity failed, water failed. Therefore, there was a problem for the civil administration. And this is what the general's wife explained to us, that there's like a horror. She's living through a horror time. Not only has she lost her only children, she said, but every day is terrible. In order to survive this period of time, which is like a Holocaust for them. This is what my impression was at the time, because this particular because she sat there for a good an hour and a half explaining the bad deeds of the Nazis, which she was intelligent enough to explain that it isn't their fault. That like something has happened to them, like a plague descended down, and of course they were all carried away with it. In a way, she apologized on behalf of the hierarchy.
Her own.
Well, by losing three of her sons and he being in the army, are you recording her? I felt that he was like, he says, I'm one of you. I'm just the same. I'm imprisoned with my wife. I lost everything. I lost my children. What I worked for, what I fought for in the First World War, everything is lost. Only because we are dealing with a plague. And the word plague, it has come about by the hierarchy, which is the government, and of course, which we have got no control over. So this is how this is my recollection of this particular thing. And of course, that was soon after this. The Russians were advancing, and again, we were then put. Shall I continue? We are then put into a train. Back into Czechoslovakia, Trasenstadt. And this was a most horrific journey because it took us only about 10 to 12 days, of which several, probably 1,000 inmates were put in from Buchenwald onto open trucks. And it was April. Horrific weather, where you got snow and storm and rain, open trucks for us to be in for 2 days, and I just got over pneumonia a few months ago. We left about, say, 1,000 or so who left the Buchenwald, and 2 weeks later, about 300 to 400, at least a third, two-thirds died on this way. The reason for that was because there was no food, there was no organized, when we used to go into sidings, because the railway track used to be either broken or bombed the previous night, there was no organized power to feed us, so we had to go out and fend for ourselves. And there was nowhere to go except go back into the truck, because that was our temporary home. And of course, during that time, due to the facilities, washing facilities, people died and there was nowhere to bury them in the truck. And so that the disease was rife. There was no food. The wet, the damp was so severe that the people who have survived so far couldn't survive beyond that. And of course, once we arrived to Czechoslovakia, to Trasenstadt, within a couple of days, the guards were guarding us disappeared. And there was no electricity. We arrived middle of the night. And of course, we got to a place where we were for the first time given hot soup. Because Trasenstadt was an organized concentration camp from even before the war. And the facilities there were meager, but they were there. And we were given clothes, and we were given. We were taken into rooms where we could sleep. There was no beds. I mean, you slept on the floor, but it was dry after having the experience being wet rained upon. We then recovered slightly, and of course, the Red Cross came within 2 days, because I was very ill, having suffered with pneumonia, and I was given by the Red Cross, it was in late April 1945, a sardines. The first time I had sardines forever. I don't remember having sardines. And this upset me, and I had tummy ache, and I died because of it. Because I was eating sardines with any bad. And then I eat sardines on an empty stomach. I was not used to having sardines. And one thing, I survived, but I was nearly a death door physically. At that time, the people who were fit within the camp, there was about 300 of us, which came from the group, went out, and of course, the German or the German Czech German had white flags showing that they'd given up. No, there. And of course, anybody who was fit was going out, and what they did, I don't know, because I wasn't fit to do this. And used to come back with wines and goodies like this. And of course, I wasn't party to it because I could not, I wasn't well enough. But I was given my share to drink. And of course, very soon afterwards, the Russian administration arrived. And they've taken the civil administration. Because I remember when I first went out, and this is a marvelous experience to watch, when an army is on the move, and when you see tanks, lorries, cars, kitchens, hospitals, all on wheels, moving along, and say one lorry breaks down, and a tractor comes up, pushes out the way, an army on the move, it was the Russian army towards Berlin. It was a fantastic sight for somebody who's never seen. They wouldn't stop, and we could understand Russian. We asked them to stop, and they used to throw either cigarettes, which, you know, the prisoners had seen for many years, bars of chocolates. But they couldn't stop because it's like a moving town, day and night. But they all said in Russian that the civil administration is coming. They know of us. It's been transferred. They're on the way, but they can't stop. And of course, the army, the hospitals, and they would not stop for anybody. Just kept moving day and night for at least 3 nights. It's like a swarm of but eventually, the civil administration arrived, and they started taking charge. Brought their own food in, brought their own doctors in. We got ourselves registered. It was the first time where we had normality. And this is where they said, look, anybody over the age of 16 has got to go to the Russian army. So straight away, fortunately, I was one of the boys who were just, I was just 15 and three quarters. And they said, look, most of the boys wanted to go back home because being children, we were children, we're all 15, 16, 17 year old boys. We wanted to go back home. And they said, now, some of them did. I knew what happened to my family because I was there in 1945. Some of these boys left their home in 1940. I didn't know what happened to their parents or their family. In my case, I knew that I'd lost everybody, and I was sort of on my own, but I did know that I had a brother in England. So I put my name down that I want to go to England. They said, that is a restricted situation because very few people are allowed to come in. And I said, well, I've got a brother, so we have arranged to send a telegram to my brother, and well, that's another story. I'll probably come on to it later. But the life in trip in Tretestad was really, in my case, of recuperation, because I was nearly at death's door due to overeating or eating the wrong things. I wasn't used to the oily foods or foods which I hadn't used for many, many years. And because of this, and of course, oranges were thrown at us, and which you haven't seen at all, ever. Bananas and things like this. So, of course, by the Russian army. This was very upsetting to us because we weren't used to it. And a lot of people fell ill and died because of it, due to dirty overeating or eating things which didn't agree with them.
Were you more careful, with your eating after that first sardine? Did you take a little more care?
I did, and we went back to basic foods like bread. Bread, because butter was also not on the menu. And this is what we felt, that bread was something which our constitution could manage. And the bread and soup, basically, which was a liquid, the soup again was a root type vegetable soup. It wasn't soup with meat or anything like that, was not available. But the Russians were, under the Russian regime, because once the Russian administration came in, they brought their own food in, the Russian black bread, which I remember clearly, and that suited us because it was army rations, as it were. And this was the base of what I remember about the camp, that we went through a system of medical tests, and the Russian doctors came along, and I remember three of my friends, one of them broke a leg, and he wasn't allowed to come. Because anybody who was allowed to come to England had to be of good health, passed by medical. In other words, anybody who was ill had to be either stopped on or going to hospital and be treated. And I was fortunate again that I was passed as fit. They could only find some. Three hundred boys and 50 girls who were taken to Prague by the Russian army, and we were then sent from Prague directly to Manchester, I believe it was Manchester Airport, and we are flying in British Lancaster bomber planes, where we are met by UNRWA, and UNRWA, I understand, the United Nations organization, was responsible for our going there. And we are then taken, and of course, the partisans, Czech anti-German, were very, very active, helping us at the same time. They were trying to, they used to round up all the German, Czech German, and they were getting their own way with them by virtue of beating them. I've seen it with my own eyes, because that was the only time when the Czechs, young Czechs, could take retribution against the Germans while there was no civil administration of the Czechs laws. I mean, it was really a free-for-all at that time. And to survive that turmoil means you've got to be lucky, because, you see, the innocent were hurt due to no reason, because if you've got a turmoil and you have no law and order, people get hurt. That was my experience.
Before we go on to your experience in England, could I ask you a little more about this period in Theresienstadt and your journey there? You were saying about this awful journey that you had to Theresienstadt. Would that perhaps have been the worst thing you went through, would you say?
This was the worst because I personally was at a very low ebb. I was in a state getting over double pneumonia. The weather conditions were severe. We were in open trucks, which meant no roof, with continuous snow or rain. So we could sleep day and night, but we had nothing to eat. So we had to get out and try and find food. With wet clothing day and night without change, on the move, so there's no sanitation. So what happened, it was the worst time, if I remember, and now how any of us survived it, I don't know, because not only was there starvation and bad weather, but freezing bad weather, without any organized power, because the Germans ran away, basically. We were free to go, but where would you go? There was nowhere to go, because the only way you had to go and get food. And food was, at that time, the last thing on my mind, because I had reserves of food within me, because I was fortunate enough having the right town in Skalzisko, fetting, it's like preparing myself for this bad time. But the difficulty there, I feel that this was the worst time, as far as I can remember, to survive that area, that period of time, was the most horrific, because it was lack of food, lack of sleep, cold, ice, no sanitation, no water to drink. Well, the only water to drink was the rainwater or snow. And people who were dying or very, very sick had to stay where they are because there was no way of moving them. This was, I feel, the worst time of our group. And the few of us who survived is a miracle.
And this went on for, did you say, 2 weeks?
About 10 days to 2 weeks. We went on the move all the time. We were moving when we could. If the railway was... We didn't know where we were going. We didn't know if we left Germany or we... Because when we stopped, we should stop at sidings and other trains used to go past from, you know, Czech or the German, I don't know what they, but we heard trains going past when we were in sidings, and we were there unguarded, but there was nowhere to go. So it was the worst time, and that was something which, as I say, to survive that period was a miracle.
You were saying how all through the war, you know, you had this feeling that the will to live and the feeling you would survive. How did you feel at that time? Did you ever feel that perhaps you weren't going to get through?
Well, I always felt that, because coming back to what my father said just before, when we discussed the war, when I overheard him speaking to other people and to my mother, and he said that it is not going to last very long. The war is going to be finished sort of in a few weeks and a few months' time. At that time, I remember that America came into the war. They said that there's no way that we can we don't want to do anything which will, sorry,